From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama's new national security foreign policy team clicked fully into place yesterday when he moved UN Ambassador Susan Rice to National Security Advisor and nominated human rights champion Samantha Power to fill Rice's seat at the UN. You can see this as a beltway story. Defiant president sticks thumb in the eye of Republican critics after the rage over Rice and Benghazi. But its big world impact comes right behind. Syria, Iran, China, more, all lined up for attention, all with consequence. This hour on Point, the Susan Rice appointment and the new Obama national security team. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is this a president saying, don't tread on me? What's it mean for U.S. foreign policy, security? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was the president yesterday at the White House introducing his new national security advisor.
Susan was a trusted advisor during my first campaign for president. She helped to build my foreign policy team and lead our diplomacy at the United Nations in my first term. I am absolutely thrilled that she'll be back at my side leading my national security team in my second term.
Susan Rice saying, happy to be there, deeply honored.
I'm deeply honored and humbled to serve our country as your national security advisor. I'm proud to have worked so closely with you for more than 6 years, and I'm deeply grateful for your enduring confidence in me.
She will have a big agenda. Republicans, some, went right to one point in that spectrum. The Benghazi story, Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul went right after it.
To reappoint or to promote, basically, the person who is guilty of misleading us over the Benghazi tragedy, I can't imagine, one, that we would be keeping Ambassador Rice in any significant position, much less promoting her to an important position. How are they going to have the authority for people to believe what they're saying when he's promoting someone who directly and deliberately misled the public over Benghazi?
Later in this hour, we will go to Istanbul, where Turkey's current round of riots and crackdown began and continue. But joining me now from Washington is James Kitfield, senior national security correspondent at the National Journal. James, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to do it, Tom.
Why this appointment first, Susan Rice, and why now, James?
Well, I think it's an appointment because the president really likes this person. I mean, he's had her first in line probably to be the next Secretary of State because of the Benghazi controversy. That wasn't going to happen. So he moved her to his top national security advisor when Donilon decided to leave. I think that it just shows that, you know, over a long period of time, he has shown a level of comfort with her worldview, with her sort of, you know, her expertise, and he likes her. And I think he was also sending the message that, you know, this is not a position that has to be confirmed by the Senate. I like and respect this person, and I'm going to elevate her.
Is it a thumb in the eye of the Republicans who have been such intense critics of Susan Rice? And given that he can appoint her without their sign-off, does it matter if it is?
Well, I don't think it's a thumb in the eye in the sense that I don't think President Obama ever thought that the whole Benghazi controversy in her comments 5 days after that attack really was a fair attack. I mean, he was very clear in his press conference afterwards that he felt they were ganging up on her, and he released all of those emails that show that, you know, the talking points for that, for her appearance on those shows were hashed out between the intelligence agencies, the State Department, and the White House, and no one person determined what was going to be said, but everyone eventually signed off on the talking points that she you know, delivered that day. So the idea that she somehow is personally responsible for misleading the country, I don't think he ever bought into that narrative, and personally I haven't seen very many journalists who believe that either.
You could hear his emotion around that. This was last November. He called you an ambassador, then Ambassador Susan Rice, extraordinary at a cabinet meeting where she had really been under fire.
Susan Rice is extraordinary. Couldn't be prouder of the job that she's done at USUI.
So you may find it unfair criticism, or he may, James, but you heard the heat of the Republican criticism here. How does it matter, or does it matter, if the president's national security advisor is taking, surely will take, significant political heat simply for being there?
Well, it's, you know, it's a position where the presidents have always had a lot of latitude to pick someone who they are very comfortable with, and it's not someone that you tend to send up to Capitol Hill to assuage Congress. That's something that Vice President Joe Biden, that's a role that he has taken in the Obama administration. So I don't think it's, you know, I don't think you'll see a lot of her up on the Hill trying to sell his policies or, you know, explaining his policies. I think it's really the alter ego of the president on matters of national security, and like I said, I think that he feels that their worldviews are in sync in that way, and he's comfortable with her. And quite honestly, I think a lot of senators who, even if they may object to it, realize that this position is not something that that they have a huge say in.
Tom Donilon, the outgoing national security advisor, was key in helping move the U.S. out of the Middle East, out of conflicts, pivot toward Asia. Susan Rice and Samantha Power, nominated to succeed her as U.N. ambassador, were key in getting the U.S. into the Libyan intervention. Now we've got Syria, Iran, China talks coming up right in front of us here. Do you see a more assertive U.S. security position with Susan Rice in that position, James?
Well, that's certainly something that we're all going to be looking very closely at. I mean, as you said, Tom Donilon was considered a process guy who made the trains run on time, who kept peace between the cabinet officials and made sure that each one of them got their voices heard in the president's ear on issues important to them. He was seen as very cautious. He along with Joe Biden, who he's very close to, was an advocate for getting out of Afghanistan sooner rather than later. That brought him into some conflict with the U.S. military commanders. But he is seen as a pragmatist and someone who's quite cautious. As you mentioned, you know, Rice and Samantha Powers kind of cut their teeth on issues of genocide and humanitarian issues. And the question remains, will they be more assertive? Will they argue for a more assertive U.S. response to issues like Syria? Obviously, it tops the agenda right now.
And personal style, finally, Jim, she's said to have sharp elbows, quick wit that can be cutting. How's that work in the White House?
That's a really good question. I mean, she's going to have the imprimatur of the president, so that's going to give her a lot of power. She has run an efficient shop at the United Nations, but she has a famously abrasive personality, and that's going to be a change from Donilon, who, again, is kind of a quiet, he has his own temper, but he's not nearly as abrasive a personality as Rice has. So that'll be another question that we'll all be looking very closely at.
James Kitfield with the National Journal in Washington. Thanks for joining us, James.
Happy to do it, Tom.
Here's the president again naming Susan Rice as National Security Advisor.
She is at once passionate and pragmatic. I think everybody understands Susan is a fierce champion for justice and human dignity, but she's also mindful that we have to exercise our power wisely and deliberately.
With us now from Washington, Heather Hulbert, Executive Director of the think tank National Security Network. As a speechwriter and member of the policy planning staff at the State Department during the Clinton administration, she worked closely with both outgoing National Security Advisor Thomas Donilon and the incoming Susan Rice. Heather Hulbert, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of international security studies at the U.S. Military Academy, West Point. She was Senator John McCain's national security advisor during his 08 campaign. Corey Shockey, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Heather.
Hello to all, and thanks for being here. Heather Hulbert, what do you make of this appointment and this appointment now by the president of Susan Rice?
So the first thing I'd say is this was clearly planned well in advance and orchestrated, and I think people are overplaying it as a shocking departure from anything, given that, as you have reported, Susan's been with Obama since the very beginning, and as UN ambassador, she's been in every cabinet meeting, every principals meeting of importance, putting her input in. So this is Obama being Obama at a very profound level, and this is the people he feels comfortable with, the national security team he wants, and the people whose advice he's been listening to all the way along.
What does Obama being Obama mean? What do you mean when you say that, Heather?
Well, one of the things I think you see with just about every president of either party, and Corey will speak to this as well, is in the first term, especially if you come to it without much of a national security background, you appoint people who you're confident are going to guide you, are going to be, the famous no drama, and who are going to use their instincts as much as yours. In Obama's case, to clean up the wars and the situation that presented themselves when he came into office. In a second term, you tend to see presidents turn in a different direction. and appoint people who were more their confidants. And this, you saw Condoleezza Rice get promoted in the second Bush term. You saw Madeleine Albright under Clinton. And so this is a president expressing, I mean, in as much as presidents express anything personal about themselves through their appointments, I think that's what you're seeing here.
Corey Shockey, what's more important to you top level? We just have a minute before the break. But just to begin, is this more important as a potential policy turn, or will it turn out to be more important in political terms, where she is a loaded name in Washington?
I actually don't think it's very important in either term. I agree with Heather's judgment that this is the president rewarding loyalists. Both Susan Rice and Samantha Power are people who Secretary Clinton probably wouldn't have taken into the mainstream of the State Department because of the role they'd played in the campaign. But the National Security Advisor, as James Kitfield pointed out, doesn't have to be confirmed, so the president can reward Susan Rice without having a firestorm or preventing her from getting confirmed in Congress.
Do you see the potential for a more assertive U.S. foreign policy profile as we look at Syria and Iran and China tomorrow, the president and Xi Jinping?
No, I don't. I actually think that lumping Susan Rice and Samantha Power both as interventionists does a great disservice to Samantha Power. Remember, Susan Rice is the person who in the Clinton administration insisted and policed that people not call what was happening in Rwanda genocide because that would create the necessity of us doing something about it.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama naming Susan Rice as his new national security advisor. She got to know the hot seat as UN ambassador over Benghazi. Now she's headed to the White House. Samantha Power headed to the UN. Later this hour, we'll look in on Turkey. But first, right here with these substantial new appointments, Corey Shockey joins us. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, author of State of Disrepair and Managing American Hegemony. Heather Hulbert is here, executive director of the think tank National Security Network. The president was fierce last fall in defending then UN Ambassador Rice after Republican attacks on her early and controversial read on what happened at Benghazi.
If Senator McCain and Senator Graham and others want to go after somebody, they should go after me. And I'm happy to have that discussion with them. But for them to go after the UN ambassador, who had nothing to do with Benghazi, and was simply making a presentation based on intelligence that she had received, and to besmirch her reputation, is outrageous.
The president in November. Corey Shockey, that was one of the most memorably emotional moments we've seen from this president. Does that emotion matter going forward with her at his side as we look at lots of challenges in foreign policy and national security?
I agree with Heather's earlier point that the president picked someone he's comfortable with, somebody whose advice he's taken for a long time, and that is one model of being national security advisor. And in fact, I think because this administration has tended to hold policymaking decisions in so tight a circle of the president, Tom Donilon, and Dennis McDonough, and not have those decisions be more collaborative and with power centers around the administration, that I actually think she could be potentially very helpful to the president by giving other parts of the administration a better idea of what the president actually wants.
And what about at the UN, Samantha Power coming up? She and Rice did push in the Libya case for intervention, but you say interventionist is the wrong tag for her. How will she be seen arriving in New York?
I don't think it's the wrong tag for Samantha Power. I think she has long been an ardent, substantive voice for human dignity, and that intervening in ways that protect human rights and advance human dignity is in American interest. She's the real deal on this, and I actually think she's a terrific appointment to the UN. She knows the institution well. She's an advocate for it having a leading role. That, by the way, is consistent with what the president thinks. And I think she'll be very effective there.
Heather, what do you see coming out of Samantha Power's presence in New York?
Well, the point I would make a little bit in distinction from what Corey said is U.S. policy on Syria is shifting and has been shifting up to now, not because of personalities or not because of where people sit, but because of changes on the ground, the regionalization of the conflict and the way that it, in addition to the horrifying humanitarian consequences, affects different American interests. So I do think we're going to see changes in the U.S. policy towards Syria in coming months that won't so much be laid to the door of the two personalities that we're talking about. In terms of what you will see from power at the UN, as Corey said, she knows the UN really well, and she knows it in a very different way from people that we've sent there in the past. You know, the idea of sending someone who's been a journalist, who's been an activist, who's been on the ground, who's seen the UN at its absolute best and also at its absolute worst, but who comes in and, you know, when she goes into those horrible, endless bureaucratic meetings and says, no, this has to be fixed, she'll be heard differently because she's been out and eaten in UN mess halls and, you know, walked around with peacekeepers on the ground. So that is going to be just a really nice signal of how much the U.S. actually does put into the UN and put into international cooperation and cares about pragmatically actually making it work. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that from her, but that's very different from the big challenges we face, Syria, Iran, particularly in the UN context, others. You mentioned China that won't play out so much at the UN, where, you know, both of them have been key voices in developing an administration policy up to now. And so you're just not, you know, they've been part of this game all along. You're just going to see them more visibly than you have.
I remember going into the Balkans, 20 years ago now, and a young Samantha Powers being there as a very outspoken reporter looking at the humanitarian issues there. Looking forward, Corey, do you see Susan Rice and Samantha Powers as a team that will take us into Syria in a more material way after this period of kind of being on the sidelines?
I think that overstates both of their influence. You know, the president clearly doesn't want to go into Syria. He said the tide of war is receding. He said we're going to pivot to Asia and extract ourselves from these messes in the Middle East. He's let it go on for 2 years and 80,000 people killed by the Syrian government. I think the president's the center of gravity on this. I think Susan Rice has the potential to make sure people understand the limits the president wants to put on the problem. And she's a good voice for that because she's clearly influential, has been influential in shaping it, and is also an influential advocate of it. But remember, Susan Rice doesn't know anything about defense policy. She doesn't know anything about the budget. She's not a heavyweight national security expert, and I think there are real questions about her ability to effectively make the interagency work. So I don't think she's going to be, you know, standing astride the administration like a colossus.
But she will be at the president's elbow. I want to listen to a little bit. This was Lindsey Graham yesterday. This was on Fox News' Hannity show. South Carolina's Lindsey Graham talking about Benghazi, but also Obama foreign policy and what imprint she might have the moment at which she's coming in. Here's Graham on Fox.
She was selling the strength of the president's foreign policy. She was providing deceptive and misleading information about the true facts in Benghazi. She has a credibility problem, I think, with the average American. She is chosen by the president to be his national security advisor. She was unconfirmable as Secretary of State. Having said all that, I will work with her because the world is about to blow up. Barack Obama's foreign policy is a failure, and our friends are scared and our enemies are emboldened.
I'll work with her because the world's about to blow up, says Lindsey Graham. And here's NBC's chief White House correspondent Chuck Todd. This was on MSNBC's Morning Joe, saying that Lindsey Graham and John McCain, they may be more amenable to working with her than the earlier politics would suggest.
Ideologically, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, that crowd, that part, the loudest voices, if you will, that were critical of Susan Rice at the time, do like Susan Rice's hawkishness when it comes to, for instance, where she was on Libya, where she may end up being on Syria. She is a driver when it comes to being a believer in using U.S. power to intervene on during humanitarian crises.
Heather Hulbert, Cory Shockey is saying, well, you won't see a heavyweight interagency power in Susan Rice. She doesn't have that kind of background, that kind of throw weight. But she is very close to this president. In terms of course, the president makes the decision, but in terms of influencing this, whether we get more involved in Syria or not, what do you see her influence likely being?
Well, it's a profound misapprehension of Susan to suggest that she's low on throw weight. Someone who ran a bureau at the State Department has been running the U.S. mission at the U.N., spent plenty of her career at the National Security Council. That's a background comparable to many other national security advisors in recent history. Certainly, Donilon hadn't worked on the defense side. Condoleezza Rice hadn't worked on the defense side. So, you know, she comes in with at least as much throw weight as many of her Tony Lake would be another one, Sandy Berger. And, you know, as you said, with a really unique relationship with the president. So I would expect her to have at least as much throw weight as Donilon or, you know, say oftentimes, you know, if you get a more of a technocrat like a Steve Hadley, who was your second term Bush person who, you know, had no political influence, but plenty of throw weight. So I'm not at all worried about her lacking throw weight. And again, on Syria, I actually think, you know, the reason that people who have been more interventionist on other issues within the administration have not been more vocal than they have on Syria is that there isn't anyone who has put forward, tragically, a plan that would actually work to stop the killing and stop the fanning of the killing by regional influences on both sides. You know, and we lived through this in Bosnia, and Samantha wrote very eloquently about it at the time when she was not in government.
Right.
But it's unfortunately not just as simple as saying we want to stop the killing. And so I think you'll see an intensified search for those options. But up to now, you know, my understanding is both Rice and Power have been pretty clear with people in their inner circle that they just don't see good choices.
Can the president, can the White House, can the United States limit this problem? And if not, if it's just growing, despite the clear Obama wish that it not, how do you think Susan Rice will advise responding to that growth if it does begin to go even more regional with all the consequences that might ensue?
Well, it's clear that the administration, and again, this predates these personnel moves, it has been thinking about what more should it be doing. And the goal is going to become, I think, how do we limit so that what is already a tragedy of unacceptable proportions in Syria doesn't become a generational mass tragedy across the region. And as I said, where we need to go next is saying seriously, if the alternative is hundreds of thousands of casualties and multiple governments destabilized, what can U.S. leadership contribute to preventing that? The answer to that is unfortunately not at all clear, but that's where the discussion is going to be going as the Israelis, the Jordanians, the Turks get more and more anxious about the regionalization.
Is there a model in Libya, Cory Shockey, or is that another breed of situation entirely?
Well, I do think that Libya has the potential to be a model. And one of the things I would hope that Samantha Power and Susan Rice are worried about Libya is that the way the administration limited our involvement actually did tragically little to help set the Libyan government up for success. For example, the government and its military aren't strong enough to disarm the militia. Those militia have been a hugely destabilizing factor and were involved in the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi. They're still not disarmed. The French intervention in Mali, which was very effective and very helpful to American interests, has pushed some of the jihadists there into southern Libya. There's an urgent need for us to help the Libyans get control of security in their country and to build the governing capacity to do so. And that means larger American involvement and longer duration of time. And I think anyone who advocates intervention in Syria, and I myself do, has to take on board that limited interventions leave a lot of things undone that make it hard for whoever comes to power to stabilize and control the country.
bigger involvement, more time. Those seem like themes diametrically opposed to where President Obama has tried to push in these years of the presidency so far. I want to bring our callers.
You're exactly right about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of Americans feeling sympathy toward that with war weariness, but then there are consequences to every posture, as you say. Let me bring our listeners in. Jerome in Decatur, Illinois. What do you think of the new appointments, Jerome? Thanks for calling.
Well, I think the president has a right to appoint who he wants and who he feels comfortable with. But I think going forward, the problem becomes believability. I think that right now Americans are weary of what they can believe coming from their government. Now, we've had several instances where things have not been what they've trickled out to be something different than what they were originally said to be. So although he has a right and he should be able to appoint whom he's comfortable with, I think that we as Americans are concerned about believability in terms of the policies that are coming forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerome. Believability, we'll look at that. Sister of credibility there. Beth in Schenectady, New York. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just think she's a typical government mouthpiece. Those tears that Obama showed are for himself. He's covering his tracks. And basically also her story about Rwanda, well, we've done nothing in the Congo. We've done very little in Rwanda. We've done nothing in Congo. Congo is the rape capital of the world. So I just, it's one hand washing the other. Very wealthy people, too, I might add. She comes from a very nice background. She's a big girl. She can stand up for herself. She doesn't need Obama. But it's this horrible same old, same old.
Beth, I appreciate your call. Corey, what about, is there a credibility issue or problem here, whether the president likes it or not? And again, does it matter in this seat where she's not nominated, she's appointed?
Yeah, I thought Jerome's comments were really prescient, which is that the Obama administration has a problem, which is what they are doing tends not to match with their description of what they're doing. And I frankly think the president's right. That is, we shouldn't blame Susan Rice for going out and being the tool by which the president dissembled about Benghazi. The White House is to blame for misleading us on Benghazi. But Susan Rice is forever going to be associated with that because she's the person who did the political dirty work. And I do think that will make it difficult on the credibility issue and believability issue for the White House.
Functionally, Heather, does a credibility issue matter here?
Credibility issue matters if people are determined to keep bringing it up for political reasons. What's interesting is there have been a series of further hearings on Benghazi in Washington in recent weeks. Rice's name hardly came up, and there was at no point that anyone considered her to be a primary part of the problem. So she wasn't interesting even to anyone who wanted to talk about Benghazi, which in my view is a non-scandal. But she was not even interesting to the folks who were trying to quote-unquote investigate it until she was nominated for something again. So if she has a credibility problem, it's going to be because there was a political choice made to give her a credibility problem, which is something really unfortunate that does tend to happen quite a lot in our politics these days. I also want to address, you know, what Beth said, because in fact, Ambassador Rice is a pretty not the usual choice, because she comes actually out of an Africa background, not, as Corey said, out of your classic political military background.
Yep.
And she at the UN has probably done more on Congo along with Secretary Clinton when she was in office than anybody before her. So Beth, you should actually get to know a little more what Rice has tried to do on Africa, because it's very much not business as usual.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama naming Susan Rice as his new national security advisor and Samantha Power as new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, nominating her there. Heather Hulbert is with us, executive director of the think tank National Security Network, joining us out of Washington. And from Washington, Corey Shockey, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of international security studies at West Point. We'll go in a few minutes to Turkey, where they've seen a week of of big protests and crackdown. I want to look right ahead at Syria. Susan Rice has a track record, Heather, with a number of the countries that she will still be dealing with there. Russia, number one, in New York at the United Nations. What about her reputation there, her interaction there with the Russians and others? How does it set us up for potential meeting over Syria that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, is trying to set up, for negotiations over how to deal with this very thorny Middle East problem?
Well, in her new role, she won't be interacting one-on-one with world leaders the way she did at the UN. That'll be more either Secretary Kerry or the Vice President or sometimes the President.
I mean, we're told Tom Donilon just set up most of this China meeting. That sounds pretty significant in terms of interaction.
That's Donilon's particular legacy, and that's actually something we haven't talked about as much, that he really pulled out China and the trying to rebalance so that the U.S. was focusing on Asia as much as on the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be his particular legacy, and we'll see what Rice's particular legacy is. But because Kerry and others have been so involved, the Russians know she means business. And again, as I say, there's been some reporting about her having a difficult relationship with the Russian UN ambassador. I think most Americans, given some of the things that Russia has done and countenanced, most Americans would find themselves similarly inclined.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, what we'll see is it'll be very clear that she means business, and there won't be, I think, there won't be confusion in Moscow about this message to Russia that we want to work with you where we can, and we're also not going to hesitate to push back on behavior that we think is inappropriate and counterproductive.
Corey Shockey, what about the track record and relationships she has established at the United Nations and how they may influence her effectiveness in the White House?
I agree with Heather's judgment that the reason we can't get along with the Russians is the Russians, not Susan Rice. But my experience on the NSC suggests to me that the National Security Advisor actually spends a fair amount of time involved with world leaders and advancing things that the president wants. Tom Donilon not only advanced the China trip, he's been back and forth to Moscow trying to make the administration's reset work.
Yeah.
So I don't think the personalities are dominant in that.
And Susan Rice on the pivot to Asia, that's been central to Tom Donilon's portfolio. How do you see her carrying that on or turning again? Is the president so set that that's just the way it's going to turn, Corey?
Well, I have a difficult time assessing that, to be honest, because I think the pivot to Asia was a way for the Obama White House to try and diminish the importance of the Middle East and to justify walking away from the war in Iraq, to try and limit their exposure on the war in Afghanistan, you know, to focus on something different and new. And I don't think they've actually done very much that wasn't already in track in the Bush administration. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a good thing. Shifting more Navy assets to the region is a good thing. Both of those were already underway. So I'm not sure there actually is a pivot to Asia, other than it's managed to scare people in the Middle East and in Europe that we don't care about them anymore.
Heather, real pivot or covering tracks?
So Corey and I agree on most of the substance, and we disagree on why and what it means. But what I would say has happened and will continue to happen is a rebalance that was natural and even good after the U.S. got overinvested and maybe unproductively invested in some conflicts in the Middle East that didn't turn out to have the world transformative effects that we were promised. So because any administration of any political stripe would be paying as much attention to Asia as it possibly can because of Asia's economic dynamism, because of China's rise as a power, and because of potential security conflicts there that one wants to see not escalate. So you can call it what you like. It has both military and non-military components. But again, that's going to continue not because of anybody's personality, but just because that's where the center of gravity, the future of American prosperity is. Some of the greatest long-term threats to peace, to stability, to our ability to grow sustainably are.
Let's go to Mark in Little Rock, Arkansas. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Your show is terrific. I really enjoy it.
Thanks.
Can I go back to Susan Rice for just a second?
Yeah.
I think that she's going to make an excellent national security advisor, and in fact, by sheer luck, by first of all, bad luck, that she got given bad information by the CIA and had to fall on her sword, so to speak, to take the fall for all that situation is unfortunate, but I think shifting her to national security advisor, from what I understand about her personality, about her background, and about the fact that key Republicans are going to be able to work with her, seems to be excellent luck coming around the back door, so to speak.
Mark, our time is short, but I appreciate your call, and let me get one more. Clearwater, Florida. Mark, you're on the air. Mark in Florida.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering, how does the fact that they're both appointments are females affect their relationships with countries that are not as that have more prejudice against the females in power, more or less the Arabic countries?
Yeah, Mark, let me pick it up right here. We've got two high-powered women to ask. Corey, let me come first to you. Does it matter anymore? You hear Mark's question.
I think Mark's question is a good one, but everybody around the world is pretty well acclimatized to bossy, powerful American women at this point.
I mean, we're not the only country who have women large and in charge. Heather, how about it? Does it matter? Does the gender? Here we've got the UN ambassador and the national security advisor, both women. Of course, we already had the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, as a woman. But does it matter?
Well, this has been going on for 20 years now, you know, since Madeleine Albright was first UN ambassador and then secretary. And it does take some getting used to. And, you know, when I worked for Albright, there were some instances where you definitely saw some diplomats who maybe preferred to talk to her male advisors than her. But my own personal experience, and I'm sure Corey's too, is that people learn pretty quickly that if they don't get over their prejudices when dealing with Americans, it's they who suffer, not you. The other point I just quickly want to make is these are not just both women. These are both women with children. In very modern two-career families. Rice's husband actually left his own high-powered job to be a stay-at-home dad for their two kids while she commuted to New York. Power has two small children. So this is a very, it's a very lean-in moment for Americans at the same time as it's a really interesting signal to the rest of the world.
No kidding. I guess they didn't get the memo from Anne-Marie Slaughter on leaning out. We'll talk about that on another day.
That's not what Anne-Marie said.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. But that's the shorthand a lot of people took. We'll look at that another time. I'm grateful to the two of you for helping us raise the curtain on this appointment and this nomination. Heather Hulbert at the National Security Network. Thank you very much for joining us, Heather.
It's great to be with you.
And Corey Shockey at the Hoover Institution. Thank you, Corey, for being with us today.
It's been a real pleasure, Tom.
In a moment, we go to Istanbul to learn more about the rioting and discontent in Turkey. This is On Point. It has been a week of protest in cities across Turkey. One policeman and three protesters have been killed. Thousands have been injured. It was all precipitated by a demonstration over a redevelopment project in the heart of historic Istanbul. But the reasons go deeper. Hugh Pope was for many years the Wall Street Journal's man in Istanbul. He's a co-author with Nicole Pope of Turkey Unveiled, A History of Modern Turkey. And he is director of the Turkey-Cyprus Project for the International Crisis Group. He joins us now from Istanbul, where it all began. Hugh, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Can we go back to the beginning? So it's been a while since I've been in Istanbul. Beautiful city, but people there are sensitive, or at least some, about this green space in the heart of the old city, sensitive enough to come out and really protest about it. Many things may have been layered on top since then, but describe the significance of how this began, Hugh.
Istanbul is a city where 98.5% of the urban space is concrete or built on. So the significance of these excavators moving in to take just a few of the trees, in fact, off a corner of that square, turned out to be the actual spark that ignited many of these protests. But as you rightly point out, there was a lot more going on before that.
So begin to take us there. First come the people who don't want to see this turned into a shopping mall, 98.5% concrete. We can perhaps all sympathize with that. Why have so many more joined? Why has the government responded so fiercely? What's going on here?
this is a country where we've had 10 years of one leader, one party, and a remarkably effective government that's changed a lot of things in Turkey. It's, in fact, if you haven't been here for a long time, you'd be surprised at how green bits of Istanbul are now, but there's so little green that people actually take picnics on the bit of green on roundabouts and between
in
highways.
Traffic, yeah.
There's been a steady drumbeat in the last few months of enormous infrastructure projects being inaugurated by the Prime Minister, including a new bridge across the Bosphorus, which will apparently mean cutting down a million trees, the plans for the world's biggest airport, another 2 million trees, big hilltop that can be seen from many places in Istanbul, where there will be a new mosque, which was designed in a competition that very few people know what criteria were applied to it, and that's again a project for the Prime Minister. Downtown district completely nationalized and then turned into a kind of upmarket housing district that's being done. Roma district of Istanbul, same thing, became a gated community. There's just one thing after another, and there's a feeling that people are not being consulted. And the first time I noticed that something was new was afoot was in mid-May, when the government announced very suddenly that they were going to introduce new restrictions on the sale of alcohol in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, not very different from some states in America, I think the new the rules and regulations certainly wasn't a ban, but this ignited an absolute storm on social media in the Western secular middle class of Istanbul, which unfortunately doesn't really have a political voice at the moment because the opposition parties in Turkey are so weak and divided. And this set a tone of, we are not being consulted, our lifestyles are possibly going to be threatened by events that we cannot control. And that anger carried over to the moment when this excavator started plowing at tugging at those trees in Taksim Square and Gezi Park, which then turned into these protests. And what happened then afterwards was that the remarkable brutality of the police that intervened against these very peaceful environmentalists who were actually camping at the park to try and save the trees made a lot more people come. And then the fact is that the gas that is used by the police, it just made people more angry. It didn't succeed in scattering them, at the same time it didn't actually it made people angrier. So there's been a cycle of violence. But the interesting thing in the last couple of days, at least, is that the ruling party has shown some empathy. We've had some very good statements from the president and the deputy prime minister. And in Istanbul right now, we're waiting for the prime minister to return from a tour of North Africa, and everyone is on tenterhooks to see what he will say when he steps off the plane.
Reports I was just hearing from the BBC out of Tunisia, where he's notably been and stayed, even as this went on, didn't rush back. A pretty tough tone from Prime Minister Erdogan. A couple of questions here. You go from a green space park to a shopping mall from a distance. No idea, but it can sound like a high-handedness or corruption. Are those the fears, or is it more just about a kind of authoritarian my way or the highway thing people are protesting? And does it boil down somehow at the same time to religious versus secular old tensions in Turkey?
All of the above. There's a car that has been turned upside down and burnt in the middle of Taksim Square at the moment, which hasn't been cleared away because the police and the main authorities have still just left it for the demonstrators by day, tourists taking photographs. But anyway, this car has is like a wishing tree. It has all kinds of groups' demands on it, and it's almost as if a barrier of fear has come down, and all the groups, yes, as you mentioned, the secularists, the people who are angry about corruption, the people who worry about high-handedness, the ones who are loyal to the memory of the secular founder of the Turkish Republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, mm-hmm. all of them are coming together, even gays, bisexuals, Alevis, Kurds, everyone is there with their own message. And saying it out loud, it's almost there's a happy feeling, there's a happy energy on the streets of Istanbul. I know it sounds strange when you've probably been seeing images of the clashes on the barricades.
Mm.
On the whole, I think it's a remarkably positive development, because there's been a sense that everyone's been holding back, everyone's been biting their tongue because they're scared of this very powerful party and man leading the country, probably to an excess, because this country, you know, it's not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's even a new sense of humor. I mean, people have lightened up, and that's sort of put a new smile on what's normally quite a stern national narrative here in Turkey.
Final question, just a minute here. Is it all domestic, the energy around this, or is it somehow attuned to the instability and chaos, crisis next door in Syria, heating up the atmosphere, or not?
There's been a lot of questions about, is this a Turkish Spring? Well, in a way, if it's about people asking for more freedom, yes. But, I think there are more comparisons to other protests we've seen in Europe. You know, remember the poll tax riots in England, mm-hmm. after Margaret Thatcher had been in power for 10 years. I think it's much more similar to that. We've got to remember that this is not like the other Middle Eastern states. There's a perfectly respectably elected government with more than nearly 50% of the vote just 2 years ago. There are going to be other elections in the next 2 years, which everyone knows will allow the population to express their political preferences. So it's not about bringing down a regime like in the Syrian crowds are shouting about let this mm-hmm. order fall. It's much more, please, Prime Minister, hear our voice.
Hugh Pope is director of the Turkey-Cyprus Project for the International Crisis Group, joined us from Istanbul. Hugh, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.